everyone, and welcome to Minute 63 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Andrea Loaf, a Die Hard fan who actually was able to get an article published in an academic journal about Die Hard. So welcome back, Andrea.
Thank you.
It's so much fun. It's been so much fun talking to you all week, you know, and I'm going to continue enjoying to talk to you, even though I'm going to have to cut you off in a second because I need to talk to Theo to ask him a few things. But, you know, but I don't want to really bother him while he's working, but still, you know. So minute 63 begins with Hans trying to contact Theo and ends with Hans insisting everything is going according to plan. Mm-hmm. Even though it doesn't look that way to us, but who knows? You know, we'll get there. We'll get there. So yesterday's minute ended with Carl informing Hans that, Marco is down on the street and Heinrich is dead and his bag is missing with the detonators.
He had the detonators. I just love saying that every time.
And basically what Hans then does is he picks up his radio, starts punching in a whole bunch of different, little codes or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then we hear him say, Theo, Theo. He says it twice.
Yo.
And then we get a shot of Theo and he goes, yo, that's a great way for someone to respond to their boss, you know, especially if you know that your boss is a sociopath.
Yeah. You know, who just killed someone in front of you.
That's right. I don't know if that's the best way to answer. Not really sure.
He keeps it casual.
Yeah, he definitely keeps it a little bit too casual. I think that's part of the problem. You know, he's doing a nice job of it, but he's a little too hip for Hans.
I think he knows Hans needs him though, because I think he has the technical computer skills that at that time not very many people had. In the late 80s when computers were kind of getting...
Yeah, but forget about that. Even if Hans knew of someone else who has that skill, he's not going to be able to get them over to Nakatomi that quick to take care of it tonight.
Exactly. So he needs Theo. So I think Theo has a certain level of comfort that, you know, I am not expendable because I am the person that's doing this work on the computers.
Even though that we've discussed this numerous times about the fact that Hans is compartmentalizing everything. You know, Hans is the only one who knows the entire plan. You know, we know that Theo doesn't know the whole plan. We know Carl doesn't know the whole plan. I had this conversation a few weeks ago with one of my guests that it's very possible that Hans is keeping this to himself because he's concerned that if anyone else knew the entire plan, they would kill him.
Oh.
Even though he's the brains behind the whole thing and he needs it. You know, we had a whole debate as to whether, you know, whether he's like the Joker in The Dark Knight or not. You know, the Joker has everyone do their job in order to eventually kill them all.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think that Hans is that sadistic. I think he would have been willing to do that if everyone turned on him.
Yeah.
But I don't think that was his original plan. Because you see the trio of Hans, Carl, and Theo as the three main bad guys. But you never really know. But you know, Hans is still the one completely in charge. You know, he's the one who's planned everything out completely.
Yeah.
And at this point, then Hans says to Theo, we may have some problems. How's our schedule? And he says, three down, four to go. Which is an interesting response for him because he said before that he has to get through six locks, but the seventh lock is out of his hands.
So it
should be three down, three to go.
Yeah.
Because the other one's out of his hands.
I guess and then he said, well, the fourth one's a time lock. So
no, well, right. He doesn't say it here.
Oh, okay. He just said part of the movie.
Right. No, that he said before. He said that there's six locks to get through, and the seventh lock is out of my hands because we got the time lock.
Yeah.
you
so
know,
I guess four to go to the
electromagnetic, we get an electromagnetic lock. That's what it is. So it's four to go, including that then electromagnetic one, you know. And then I love Hans's response. He goes, "Then don't waste time talking to me."
Like, you're the one that called.
Yeah, it's such a typical boss answer, you know.
Yes.
You know, you're sitting there, your boss calls you up and says, "Okay, what about this and that and the other thing?" And you say, "Well, I'm in building this and that, and that." Well, don't waste your time talking to me. Well, you, as you said, you called me.
Exactly.
I need to give you the update here. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we get a shot of Theo's computer screen, mm-hmm. and it's just really funny because this is transduction lock 3A6NX14. Which means absolutely nothing to me. You know, mm-hmm. I tried looking it up and I couldn't find anything on that. You know, but right. And then the scene changes and we see Al Powell outside. Mm-hmm. You know, he's walking, he's got blood on his forehead.
Yeah.
And he picks up his radio and goes, "This is Sergeant Al Powell of the Los Angeles Police Department. If the person who radioed for help can hear me on this channel, acknowledge this transmission. I say again, if the person who radioed for help on this channel can hear me, acknowledge this transmission." And it's great because, you know, you have all these police cars that are
yeah.
coming close to him and they're making a lot of noise and yeah, he's motioning like, for them to be quiet.
Shut up. They're going to hear you.
Yeah. And at the same time, we as he's talking, we see a shot of Hans hearing the conversation, you know, over mm-hmm. the radio.
Yeah.
And then he repeats this request also. And then, like, we see three different police cars show up that are making a lot of noise around him. And then we see John, you know, running around among the offices as this whole thing is going on. And then he picks up his radio and he goes, "I read you, Powell. You the guy in the car?" Now, why would he think that? Like, where would that come from?
Yeah, because he, well...
Like, why would he care? Like, who's, you know, you hear something going on. Like, your first instinct is going to mm-hmm. be, he's the guy in the car who was just shot up.
Yeah, welcome to the party, pal. Yeah, because I don't know if he would have been watching him get out and could have, you know. But it, I mean, we've seen how high, I mean, we saw how high that guy was when he fell, Marco.
Yeah.
So it's not like he could pinpoint, you know, these are like ants on the ground to him.
Correct.
Almost. They're so far down, he couldn't make out facial features. It's so dark, too. He wouldn't be like, he wouldn't know the guy on site. So I don't know.
Right, but again, like, why would he be
who
the,
else would
you know,
call?
Why would,
I don't know.
Why would he assume that he's the guy taking control of the situation? You know, that's
yeah, because, I mean, he was calling him Stevie Wonder earlier because he wasn't seeing anything.
Right. Exactly, because he was just driving around in circles.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. And then we get a shot of Powell, and he goes, "What's left of him?" And we see mm-hmm. that he's still bleeding. You know, he's trying to you know, he's touching his head where he's,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Poor
and,
Al.
I mean, yeah. So he does a nice job of you know, asking these type of questions to John, you know, stuff like that. You know, because he starts off by saying, "Can you identify yourself?" And he goes, "Not now,
yes.
maybe later."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, I mean, John has a great, quick response to the whole thing. You know, he knows right away, I can't identify myself.
Yeah.
You know, which is funny because he could have identified himself because Hans wouldn't have known that Holly's last name is McLean.
Exactly, yeah.
Because and even if he went into the computer system, it says Gennaro. You know,
yes.
there's no place where it says her name is McLean except mm-hmm. for seeing the picture. That's the only thing
yes.
that would theoretically give it away once mm-hmm. Hans sees John.
Yes.
You know, nothing before that. Okay. And then John proceeds to give him a little bit of a breakdown of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, "Listen fast. This is a party line and the neighbor's got itchy trigger fingers. All right. Here's the deal. You got 30 hostages on the 30th floor. The leader, his name is Hans." And at the same time, we then get a shot of Franco, not mm-hmm. Marco, Franco, inside mm-hmm. of the... Han, the office with Hans, who seems to be getting pretty pissed off that that John's giving out some information. He goes, "We have to find him and shut him up. He's telling them everything." And then Hans responds, "Let him. I'm waiting for the FBI to arrive. Until then, he can waste as much time as he likes. But we must
find the detonator."
And then he gets cut off. We're gonna have to come back tomorrow to find out what he says with that. Yeah. So, okay, first things first. John mentions that we're on a party line. So, do you know what a party line is?
Yeah, but, I don't know if it was like all the neighbors shared one line. I think it's something like that where you're on the same telephone line as like either if you're in an apartment building, like everyone on the same floor or your neighbors. So it's a party line, and you could and you would have to like listen for, because other people like would pick up the phone as well and be like, "Get off, it's for me," and you know, because you never knew who's calling. If they're calling, you could be a lot of different people.
Correct. I mean, that's the issue. A party line was a phone line that was used by numerous parties at the same time. People would save money by joining this party line as opposed to having their own private line in order to do that. And it actually started in 1878. They offered this service. And up until the mid 20th century, there were a lot of places that were still using it, especially in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Because they would get a discount. And sometimes during like World War II, those were the only lines that were available for people to use. Okay. So the biggest problem obviously is you don't have any privacy in your communication.
Exactly.
And they in the late 50s, they started using it for entertainment and gossip lines that people can get on to listen to those to those type of things. And it was also used for alerting entire neighborhoods of emergencies, whether there was maybe a fire or something like that.
So that
or
could be
terrorists
helpful.
At the Nakatomi panic at the Nakatomi Plaza. Who knows? Now there were a few times there are a few documented times where party lines caused a lot of problems. So in December 1942, there was a football game between the University of Tennessee and the University of Mississippi, and the team strategy was revealed to the opposing coach because they accidentally had the same party line. So they were able to hear the information about that. Yeah. In the 1980s, they stopped using the party lines because of all the new technologies. And private equipment that people used to use on their phones, for instance, answering machines, computer modems, things like that. You couldn't, if you were on a party line, you couldn't use these things. You couldn't use an answering machine. You know, because it wouldn't. And then, you know, once they started with call forwarding and call waiting and things like that, so that also, you know, made it more incompatible for multi-party lines.
Yeah.
So they ended up, you know, they pretty much phased them out sometime in the mid 80s with the whole thing. Right. And then he says that the bad guys have itchy trigger fingers.
Yeah.
Heard that phrase before?
Yeah, I think I have. I couldn't say where, but like I just think that whole like it's such a short and concise way to convey the information that is needed. Like he was there when Takagi got shot, and there was a countdown, but he didn't think he'd actually do it. And so he's like, "Well, these people mean business. They're gonna shoot. They're not like, I mean, any little thing, and they'd shoot their finger.
You're right.
Yeah, for sure. It's that minute." If you even if you had an itch, that trigger is gonna be triggered.
Yeah, that's correct. You're right. So I mean, the definition that I found was is that it is a person eager to fire their weapon or likely to do so unexpectedly. Again, like as you said, he didn't expect Hans to pull the trigger, and he did. Now, there's also the metaphorical trigger finger of a person with a tendency or readiness to act in haste or without consideration. A tendency to so act. So again, it could be that John's referring to either of these. He could be referring to the fact that physically, you know, or literally, they had their fingers on the triggers and they're ready to shoot somebody. Or they could be referring to the fact that they're just people that are ready and willing to do things spontaneously, you know, as quickly as possible.
And we saw that with Tony too when he first hench that was sent upstairs. And oh, he's like, you know, I'll give you a count of three. I'm not gonna hurt you. And then like, boom, like goes behind
where
he thought and just shoots. Yeah, it's like, okay, yeah, you actually are going to try to kill him. Don't lie to us.
Correct. You're right. 100%. And so pretty much, you know, we get an idea, first of all, of who Franco is here also, because of the way that he is, you know, acting very, very agitated about, I mean, again, it's his line is there for us because he's supposed to be, you know, letting us know his frustration. And it's also opening up the option for Hans to tell us, you know, part of his plan, you know, that he's waiting for the FBI to show up.
Yeah.
That type of thing. So I think that works also. That's all I have for this minute before we get to the script. Do you have anything else you wanted to mention here?
Yeah, because I think this is the we get a really good sense in this minute of it's the beginning of the Al John buddyship. Mm-hmm. And and it also shows the same sort of relationship between between Hans and Theo, and that's the buddy system of the 1980s. You know, if the black cop and the white cop, or just a black person and a white person, but it gets into the race of the buddy is always subservient to the white character. And so, you know, Al does do what he's supposed to do as a cop and take control, you know, try to get information out of him. But at the same time, he's still also at the mercy of how much information John wants to provide to him.
Right.
And the whole black techno wizard relationship, which is something that I quote in my article from Kevorkian, who's different Kevorkian from what I think everyone thinks of when they hear that
last. That's what I thought of the first time I saw that.
Yeah, different one. But that the reliance on Theo for the brain work is emblematic of cyberphobia of the late 80s, of, you know, computers are not quite at the entrenched in society to be trusted as they are, you know, now at this point. We've got the digital generation, digital natives. So it was, you know, well, we don't trust it. Let's, you know, keep the person who's doing that at arm's length from us. And it was, I'm trying to think of, there's another movie that I'm thinking of where the guy who's the computer guy is also black. And I'm thinking, I can't remember it now. But it's not uncommon. And that's, I mean, obviously enough that it shows up in this, this person's article. So I wanted to talk about that, but also the buddy system itself.
Are you maybe talking about Bad Boys? Where you had John Staley as the computer guy?
No, mine, it was like, it was a space earlier movie from like long time ago, old space movie. And I don't remember what it was anymore. If it was Spaceballs or something else, I guess Spaceballs wouldn't be as old as.
No, Spaceballs came out in 87, yeah. Came out the year before this.
Yeah.
But Spaceballs, they do have, you know, Michael Winslow in there doing the bleeps, the sweeps and the creeps, you know, where he's doing all his, all of his sound effects.
That could be it then. But there's two functions for the biracial buddy system: to place black masculinity in subservient role to white masculinity, and second, to exclude women from the center of the narrative. So going back to the differences between the novel and the film, the novel really doesn't have a whole lot of diversity in terms of race. All of the terrorists are white, and a lot of them are women too, versus in Die Hard, we get a more diverse set of terrorists, but none of them are women. You know, Holly is like our main leading lady in the entire film, even though there's, you know, like we saw Gail Wallins and, you know, other people. So it's just it's a different.
Right. I mean, it takes them three movies till they finally have a bad guy who's one of the women, who's a woman. Yeah. But I think that has a lot to do with the fact that in order to be able to show, I guess you could say, violence against a female terrorist, mm-hmm. you know, it can be misperceived.
Yeah.
You know, it's harder to show it. It's easier to state it in a novel, mm-hmm. but when you show it on screen, they have to be very careful about the way they do it and you know, and the way that John would fight with a female antagonist. So I mean, even in Die Hard 3, which we'll hopefully get to, a few seasons from now. So, she ends up dying at the end with, in the helicopter. It's not even, there's no one-on-one fight with her. Like she, whenever she is killing someone or fighting with someone, she's completely dominant in everything that happens.
And
And
it
even in
is
Die
easy
Hard 4,
to.
even in Die Hard 4, when you have Maggie Q, it's the same type of thing until they do have a scene where John is fighting her. And so that came out in 2007. So we're talking, it took them 19 years to give him an antagonist, a female antagonist that he can fight where the audience won't care that he's beating up a woman, I guess, you for lack of a
It's
better way of phrasing it.
it is harder to show on film because I mean I mentioned this probably the other day when we were talking about the differences with the novel is much more introspective. So there are these teenage like because some of them are like maybe they're like 19, 20. They're kids because in the novel Joe Leland is in his early 50s. So he's a lot older than John in the film. And so he's got some, he's feeling those feelings of, I don't want to hurt this child. And so it, so yeah, that it's that same thing that's happening of he doesn't, but you can see it because it's, the, because it's the novel. So there's more chance to show that, okay, he's not, he doesn't like hurting them or trying to kill them. It's survival. And then later, after he does kill one of the women, he's like, "I really didn't want to have to do that," and he has to sit with that. So
Yeah, but
there's a lot more. It's harder to convey that in the film. I totally agree.
I think that goes back to one of the comments you made. I think it was 2 days ago, where you're talking about you're comparing it with the Patty Hearst. So I think that's also part of the whole idea here that, in the novel, these are, these are younger, I don't know if terrorist is the right word to constantly be using here, but younger antagonists from the perspective that what they're trying to do there is they have, a political agenda as opposed to anything else. So, yeah, okay, great point. So, you have anything else you want to say about it before we get into the script?
No, because I think the other points I make about race in the article are for later parts in the movie, so not for this particular moment, no.
Okay. All right, great. So again, with the script, as we have through most of these minutes, there are minor discrepancies. For instance, Hans says, "How is your schedule?" instead of "How is our schedule?" Which again, it doesn't make that much of a difference, but I think saying "our" makes it more all inclusive. So I think that works a little better. Then they with Powell, he actually repeats in the movie, he repeats himself, but in the script, he only says it once, about if the person who radioed for help can hear me on this channel, acknowledge this transmission. He doesn't say it twice. Okay, then they have a brief description of the operations trailer, which says Powell stands in front of his destroyed cruiser and looks up the building. Behind him, technicians, city power, and light personnel. SWAT officers in protective gear, etc., arrive from all directions. A trailer is being backed into a parking lot, which will become the police center of operations. It is like watching a small town being constructed right before your eyes. So I like the descriptive way that they do that. And in McClane then gives his description, and he doesn't, first of all, or his response to Powell. So he doesn't say that they have itchy trigger fingers. He says they're trigger happy. And instead of him saying, "Here's the deal," he goes, "Here's the skinny," which doesn't work for
No.
Bruce Willis to be saying that. So it says here,
No.
there's 30 or so hostages on the 30th floor, with probably two or three guards that cover a group that size. The leader here is named Hans, and besides the pea shooter he ventilated your car with, they got machine guns and sidearms up the yin yang. On top of that, one of them has a big enough chunk of plastic explosives to orbit Kate Smith.
Kate Smith.
That's what he says. But we'll get there tomorrow, because
Okay.
that's a line that we can compare with something that's being said tomorrow. And then Hans says to Franco, the police are irrelevant. We've waited for the FBI. We're waiting for the FBI. Until they arrive, we can't finish our work. Meanwhile, let this fool waste his time with the police. So yeah. Again, it's the same thing. I think they say it more succinctly in the movie. I think it works well that it's not needed. The description is the only thing I like here. Mm-hmm. The description of everything going on behind him. The fact that saying it looks like a small town being constructed right mm-hmm. before their eyes. That's great.
And you think about at the end too, like the very end of the movie when they're panning out, you can kind of see all of that stuff.
Yes. I think next week we see it also. Or actually we see it later this week.
You can when
Dwayne shows up, we start to see that also a little bit. Mm-hmm. Right.
Dwayne.
Yeah. We'll get there. Not today though. Not today. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Hans Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five performances by Alan Rickman.
Yes.
So Andrea, what have you got for us?
Well, I realized that there are a few obvious Alan Rickman films that I have seen, but not as many. So like previous weeks, I know they're mentioning things like Galaxy Quest. I've never seen that movie. So my list might be a little different. So
we want diversity here. That's fine.
My number five is Sense and Sensibility. And I've read that novel and liked it. He plays Colonel Brandon in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And my number four is not a movie, but his appearance as King Philip in the Renfair episode of King of the Hill. I absolutely love that one, where Hank has to go give propane to the Renfair that's happening, and Peggy gets involved in how the wenches are treated, and Alan Rickman plays the king, and he's so pompous and he's awful. He's a different type of antagonist. But mm-hmm. I grew up on that one and I loved it. Number three is Love Actually, which I know is mentioned a lot. And I think he has a great character in that one. And I did end up picking, of the many Harry Potter movies available, I picked Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, because I feel like that, that introduction of Snape, yes, we get more of his character later on, but I think just that, especially Harry's perception of him is just like, he's just 11. It's his first year at Hogwarts, and Snape has a much more menacing sort of, or intimidating, I guess is a better word, appearance. And then Die Hard is my top.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah. Why am I so surprised at that?
No, that's my favorite.
Okay. Understandable. I think just almost everybody has mentioned it. I only had one guest so far who didn't even mention Die Hard on his top five of that. But everyone else has him on their top five. Most in the top position.
Mm-hmm.
So all right, great. So getting in touch with me is very simple. All you have to do is do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. And anyone who wants to get in touch with Andrea, just send me, shout out to me, and I will pass it on to her. So if you like coming back again tomorrow and continuing to talk about everything going on in the Nakatomi Building or outside of the Nakatomi Building?
Yeah. I'm ready. I feel Excellent. Like I'm all, I know this whole movie, and I'm like trying to keep myself within the box of our minute bit by bit. I mean, I can make references to what happened before, and I'm trying not to reference as much what happens after our minute as we go by.
Yeah, I have the same problem. Don't worry. All right, great. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.